Very well. So, good morning. I'm always intrigued to see people at this hour of the day. Very nice. If I were a student, okay, good. So this is where we left off yesterday. Social signal processing was the topic. We were discussing, well, various sources for social signals and behavioral cues. And we just started to dig a bit deeper into the whole possibilities, algorithmic possibilities to actually model and detect them. And for those that are interested in these things, I would point them to the lecture Machine Learning, which takes place next semester. Patrick van der Smacht and I'll be doing the central tutorial and all the other tutorials. So we took a brief glance into machine learning when we discussed Gaussian mixture models, right? So in most of these cases, what you have in a way is, in probabilistic machine learning, that is, you're having a probability distribution of such a form, right? So you're having some patterns, X, and you're having a label, Y, and some parameters, theta, right? And the parameters can be like the covariance matrix and the center of a Gaussian, or the covariance matrix center and the mixing parameters for a Gaussian mixture model, or it can be the weights of a linear regression or logistic regression or some weights and kernel parameters in support vector machines, whatever, right? And the Y, those labels are either class labels, right? And or they are function values, right? So in, if they are class labels, you are, well, heading towards a classifier. And if they are function values, you're heading for a regression system, right, that you learn. And usually, so if you start from this, what you usually do is you decompose this. With this symbol, I mean that I drop off the denominators because they're just a normalization. So in most cases, what we have is, for example, such a decomposition. So P of X, Y, and given that Y and theta times P of Y given theta. And these things we called class conditional densities. And these things we called class priors for the classification, for example, right? And this is a generative classifier system. Now, these things, what do they do? Given the class and given some parameters of the overall model or the class-specific part of the parameters, what's the distribution of the features, right? And in terms of audio, for example, you would have, let's say, five speakers, for example, then you have five classes, and each of those frames that we will be repeating in a second will be classified as belonging to one speaker or the other speaker, okay? So for each speaker, you're having such a distribution in the feature space, right? So this could be, for example, one simple Gaussian. Yeah. Let's say the feature space is two-dimensional. In the real world, it's like 50, 20, 30-dimensional. And you maybe have one Gaussian that models this speaker, right? Let's say we're very simple and say this is the mean pitch and this is the mean energy of the speaking, right, which is utterly simplified, right? Because normally, as we will see, we have many more features. And for a single speaker, this might be the class conditional density, right? And for another speaker, maybe this is the model, right? Or you could learn Gaussian mixture models as class conditional densities, whatever you like, okay? And generative classifiers. And why they're called generative? Because here, you're having a class conditional density that is able to generate patterns, right? So you can draw samples from these distribution and say, well, this is like a random sample of George's speech, right? That's, you can generate patterns. And there is another form, discriminative classifiers, which directly try to learn the class given the pattern and some parameters that are then to be determined, right? So learning in machine learning always corresponds to estimating these parameters theta, right? Either by maximum likelihood, as we saw in the case of Gaussian mixture models, or even with maximum posterior, that is just one more elaborate form where you take one more term into consideration, or even Bayesian models where you assume a distribution over the thetas and then integrate them out, right? So that's the most elaborate form in a way. Well, that's that, okay? And there's one more thing that we also saw in Gaussian mixture models. That's why they are such a good example, because sometimes you're having another quantity involved, and that's latent variables, right? So then you assume something like the probability distribution of X, Y, Z, and theta. Yeah. In the end, you just observe X and Y, because that's what your training data is made out of, right? A lot of patterns with their corresponding values. Sometimes you don't even have the values, then we speak of clustering algorithms, right? So if you don't have the Ys and just the X, well, then the target is to learn the theta such that the likelihood is maximized, for example, right? And if you're having something like that, all you need to do is to integrate those variables out. Yeah. And this is then leaves a model where you know you assume to have some latent variable set, but in the end, all you can say is, well, all I have is something like that. And you would then try to learn with these hidden variables. And that leads to, since we know that the current estimation for Z often depends on the learned parameters, and the learned parameters then depend on Z, as in Gaussian mixture models, what you usually do, or in very many cases, is expectation maximization, as we saw in this case, right? So that's just a repetition, ultra short, on machine learning, right? Now, as with speech, what we saw yesterday was that we're having the signal, right, as a function of time. And this might we call the signal S. And that's an audio signal that you get, right? And what you do is you do a quantization here, and you also segment time into discrete time frames. And taking such a time frame would then yield for every frame a vector of measurements here, right? So a vector of numbers. And this is the first part of feature generation that takes part. And then what you do is you have to obviously, so in speech, what is important is the frequencies, right? That's why you would employ Fourier transform to transform from the space S, which physically corresponds to the scalar field pressure as a function of time and space, right? We transform with Fourier transform, we transform to frequencies as a function of time, and well, that could be it, right? So if you leave out the X here, the spatial dependency, and just call it P as a function of T as it arrives at the microphone, you would transform into the frequency space with discrete Fourier transform methods, right? And obviously, if you do that frame-wise, you would have to take care that such a signal taken out here is not transformed as it is, because then what you get is all these artifacts from these cutoffs, okay? Because you know that if you Fourier transform such a signal into the frequency range, what you get is those higher order frequencies from this cutoff. So you need, in order to be able to model this with a sine wave, you need obviously more components with higher frequencies to model this edge here, right? And that's why you get these higher order harmonics. And what you can do is you can introduce a Gaussian cutoff here, which makes things a bit smoother. Okay, and these are all tricks. Now, another question is, or one of the major question in effect is, what type of features would we like to compute, right? So if you say we do a Fourier transform, then we have a 10,000 dimensional frequency space. And we know that if there's so many dimensions, it's very hard to get enough training examples. And that's called the curse of dimensionality, right? And you can easily see that. And by the way, it's explained in the Bishop chapter that I gave you, right? So you can easily see that because if you regard, for example, a simple sphere, you know that in three dimensions, you know, the volume of the sphere has a certain dependency, like x to the power, r to the power 3 something, yeah? And if you go with this sphere into higher dimensions, you'll see the effects that you need exponentially more training examples to reasonably fill the space, right? And you know, what does filling the space mean? If you're talking about speech, right, in order to be able to learn such a Gaussian here, you need reasonably many training examples in order to really tell where the Gaussian is and how it's shaped and rotated and so on, right? And this is only two-dimensional. If you go up with the dimensions, you need exponentially more training examples. That's why 10,000 dimensions is not a good idea. And that's why in machine learning, you talk a lot about feature reduction techniques, okay? And feature reduction is often an essential form, an essential task, right? Now, so just taking the Fourier spectrum is not a good idea. That's why the persons doing research there came up with these, for example, these MFCC, Mells-Hepstrom frequency coefficients. And these are very elaborate features that take care of the physiologically relevant parts of the spectrum. So you know that the ear is not a linear microphone, but a highly biased microphone. So we're very strong in the mids, like, I don't know, around 1,000 kilohertz, while, 1,000 hertz, not 1,000 kilohertz, right? That's where we hear best, whereas down something that is below 20 hertz is out of the question, so we don't hear that at all in most cases, and everything that's, so in your age, maybe 16, 18,000 hertz is also off. So that's only heard by dogs, right? It goes into ultrasound then. And so as with faces, we're very good at directing or determining where's a face and what is the expression on that face, right? So we blend out all the other things, such as the pattern here in the wood. That's simply not important, right? So when I watch a scene like this, bam, 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 my brain just focuses on your faces, right? And the same is with audio. So we focus on the frequency range that is important for communication. That's why we're so highly biased. Now, since the relevant parts of the audio that is uttered by a vocal tract is intended for other humans, it's also a good idea for the machine learning algorithms to work on features that are fine-tuned with respect to human ears, right? So that's just a sender-receiver optimization in a way, right? And these male features are a good idea there, right? Furthermore, so you can come up with things such as simple statistics like zero crossing rate of the curve, or statistics about the energy. So the energy is proportional to the square of the signal or the amplitude roughly, and so on. Okay. And that's what you do. And what you proceed as is, so the first step would be to classify, to employ a binary classifier for classifying each of the frames as speech or non-speech, as we said yesterday. And then you try, so this is a thing where, for example, you use simple Gaussian models, right? So you have a non-speech model, so for anything else, and a general speech model for human speech. And then you try to be as good as possible with this two-class classification. And once you have that, you throw out all the frames that are non-speech, and within the speech frames, you try to detect transitions. Either they are within the frame, normally with high probability, or you have just pure frames of a speaker. However, you need to kind of do that. And how do you do that? So you sometimes regard whole windows of these frames, such as several of them together. And then what you do is you need to be able to track in this window. So let's say this is the window, and there we're having a signal, right? And let's assume here we're having a transition from speaker one to speaker two, right? And then you somehow need to track that. And what you can do is you can, for example, do several of these frames and model each frame with one Gaussian. Yeah, so one multivariate Gaussian on the space of these features that we just talked about. So these are like 50, 20, 30 something. Yeah. And in this 50 dimensional space, you learn a multivariate Gaussian, just one, not a Gaussian mixture model. And then you compare the two Gaussians, right? And one way to compare probability distribution is so-called Kalberg-Leibler divergence. That's a distance measure on probability distributions, which work on the basis of information content. So we're in the space of entropies. Remember, I explained that shortly. And if the Gaussians for the two segments are sufficiently dissimilar, then you would say, okay, this is obviously one speaker, and here we're having another speaker or a mixture of speakers, right? And then you can home in that frameway or window, I should say, where you have more than one speaker, and then say, well, where exactly is the transition point? Sometimes you don't even need that in that level of accuracy. You just say, if the windows are small enough, I don't care about the precise changing point. Yeah, I would just say, yeah, highly probable that this is one speaker, highly probable that this is someone else, someone else, someone else, right? And another way to do it is to actually, if you want to do the fine-grained stuff, what you can do is model these things with one Gaussian and two Gaussians, right? So if you model something with a one Gaussian or a two Gaussian Gaussian mixture model, so it's clear that if I have a pattern like that, let's say we're still in a two-dimensional feature space, right? And I'm having patterns like this, right? So if you were to model this with one Gaussian, maybe it would look like this, okay? Something. Right. But we can already see that there are two clusters, right? So a two Gaussian Gaussian mixture model might model this thing as these two Gaussians, okay? And intuition already tells you that the more expressive a model is, the more degrees of freedom it has, the better I can fit it to the data, okay? So the likelihood that I maximize in maximum likelihood learning is systematically higher for the two Gaussian model than for the one Gaussian model. And it would even be higher for a five Gaussian mixture model or a 10 Gaussian mixture model. The only question is it significantly higher, right? So if we're having a frame with one speaker, the difference between a one Gaussian and a two Gaussian Gaussian mixture model should not make a big difference, right? If it's two speakers, we should find that the two Gaussian Gaussian mixture model is significantly more likely to explain the data than the simple Gaussian, okay? And in order to measure that, what you can use is so-called likelihood ratio tests, right? So you compute the ratio of likelihoods, and if that again has a distribution, and if that's significantly more likely, then you would vote for a two speaker frame, right? And then you can do the homing in and the more fine grained stuff. There's a lot of other techniques that you might or might not need depending on which level of accuracy you're targeting. Okay. Good. And for the clustering of the segments, so once you found segments that you would attribute to one speaker, then the question is what speaker actually is talking. Okay. So for example, in that application for availability management, where you say, I want my telephone to ring only in social situations where it's appropriate for me, right? There it is important to recognize your voice, right? Because the situations that are that you're in and that are in such a way that you don't want to be disturbed fall into several classes, and it's decisive whether you talk or whether you don't talk, right? So the goal can be to detect the presence of your voice and also the length of the bursts of your voice, right? For example, with that, you can distinguish a heated discussion that you're involved in from something where you would just comment from time to time. Yes, yes, I agree. Yeah, sure, I did the same. Yeah, okay, good. And this, the last thing could, for example, indicate a situation where you're the audience, right? So for example, if you have a meeting with your professor, then you're much more likely to just say these short bursts from time to time while the other one is talking all the time. So that's this. And in that situation, it would be much more inconvenient if your phone rang than compared to situations where you have a much higher share in the communication. Right? And if your share in communication is significantly high, if I'm the lecturer, for example, it would be inappropriate again, right? So the task can be detect your voice. And in order to do that, you need to cluster all the segments that are labeled as probably belonging to you, in order to detect your presence. And this could be done, for example, with our single link or complete link type of clustering, right? And then you can merge the segments with the most similar models. If you, for example, cut the dendrograms appropriately at with likelihood as a measure, yeah? And what you can then do, you can then retrain if you like, or do other things, right? So if you happen to have like a 10-second speech segment for you, and you train your model for your voice on that, and you happen to find 5 minutes of your voice, you can use that to retrain. What you get is an error, of course, right? Because these 5 minutes are not fully reliably detected. But then you can do bootstrapping, and then use this newly trained model again, might lead you off, might not lead you off. This is then the art form, right? And there's a whole bunch of literature on that, and we're currently running a lab course on speech and speaker recognition. If you're interested in, we might repeat that in the next summer. Good. Now, this was audio. Let's assume we're heading for video. And still we're heading towards the task of splitting up the signal time series into sub-series that belong to one person only. Now, we did this with audio. Now, can we do this with faces? Okay. Now, face detection is something that is, well researched. And if you would start with a naive approach and just compute your features on the basis of pixels only, this would be quite hard, because obviously the lighting and other things have an influence, and the rotation of your face. So pixels are maybe not a good idea, or purely pixel-based, because there are too many possibilities in effect for non-faces. And in effect, if you want to do this binary type of classifier, you're better off with other things. For example, some approaches just go for detecting the correct geometric relative position of certain patches of skin, or try to detect the eyes or other face elements. And the goal would be to have features that are robust against rotation. So this should be a face, as well as this should be a face, right? But there's a lot of things you can do. I won't get into detail about this. For example, you can also use boosting, which is a technique where you learn hierarchical systems of classifiers that in itself are very simple and not very very exact, but together they vote for certain regions to be parts of faces, and this together can be a good idea. Right? And if you want to dig into this, there's the reference to a very good article where they have this, where they use this technique. And I won't go further into that. So there is some slide later on that shows an image. Maybe I can say a few more words on that. However, once you detected your face, so that's a typical thing that even cameras can do, right? Facebook has a simple face detection algorithm in place. And there's a library that's called OpenCV that does that for you, right? So if you're having a photo and there is several people celebrating, right? It's very easy to come up with such frames that tell you, well, here are the faces, okay? Now, once you have the faces, that's face detection. Where is a face? But we still don't know who that is, right? That would be face recognition, okay? And that, again, is a simple classifier problem, okay? So let's assume those frames with the faces in are 100 by 100 pixels, okay? So if you go back to the pixel-based features for the moment, right, then you'd have a 10,000 dimensional vector. And if you take away the color, let's say we're having grayscale, 256 values, then you have a 10,000 dimensional vector with numbers from 0 to 255 in there, right? This is your features. Now, this is way too highly dimensional. So what can you do? One technique is so-called the eigenfaces technique, and it works like this, okay? So let's assume you would have a two-dimensional feature space again, right? So X1 and X2. And let's assume your features are distributed like that. Now, the question is, what dimension can you throw away if you want to do a classification? X2. Why? Yes. That's right. So, if you we're facing the problem of saying I have a very high dimensional feature space and I just want to compress it in a way that I want to throw away certain features or reduce the number of features. What you would like to do is you would like to keep the features where there is a high variance in the data, and you would like to throw away the features where the variance in the data is very small, right? Because if I were to classify a face, for example, with the feature number of the eyes, what use would that be? I can, if there's like a Greek cyclops or whatever these guys were called, well, I can probably classify that correctly. But in most faces, there are two eyes, right? Same goes for the number of noses or the rough relative position. It's all the same. So you can throw away these features. The only thing that you need to keep is directions in the feature space where the variance is highest, right? So in this case, I throw away x2 and I keep x1, okay? And these directions can also be skew in the space. So for example, if my patterns are distributed like this, right? Again, I have two features, and I know I want to throw away somehow one feature, but I cannot throw away x1 as well as not x2, right? Because the distribution is somehow something like this, okay? And what I do is I rotate the coordinate system and say this is x1 prime, and this is x2 prime, and then I can say I can throw away x2 prime and keep this direction here, right? And if you take that seriously, what you find is you compute a rotation of the feature space such that the axes come to lie in the directions of maximum variance, right? And then you throw away all the rest of the axes. Yeah, and in that way, I can keep as many features as I like. And in order to decide how many I'm going to keep, I would say that I would like to be able to explain as large share of the variance as possible such that it's convenient. If I have a 10,000 dimensional feature space, okay, and with 50 axes, I'm able to explain 99% of the variance, then I can throw away the rest 9,950 features in the rotated space, right? So what I do is I rotate and then project. And this is called principal component analysis. And these directions in the space where the variance is high are called principal components. And since you have to solve an eigenvalue problem in order to come up with these axes, right? So the in principle, you have the covariance matrix, which is something very similar to X transpose when X is the matrix of the features. Then this is your matrix A. And what you would like to solve, so is that you're seeking something AV is lambda V, and these would then be the vectors pointing in the maximum variance direction, okay? And the eigenvalues are the variances in that direction, basically, yeah? So this is why the method that just uses the reduction from 10,000 face features to, let's say, 50, this technique is called eigenfaces, because what you compute is these components of your face that just have the highest discriminative value. Okay? And that's a technique, again, co-invented by Alex Pentland in his early days. So the guy is, somehow dealing with a lot of things, right? Good. Now, let's be a bit quicker. If you want to not only detect faces, but also persons, again, since people wear a lot of different clothes, it's not a very good idea to use pixel features, right? So it's a nonsense to say only the things that have green stripes in this room are a figure. I mean, yeah, green stripes. So it's much more convenient to look for general human shapes. And what you can do is you can run an edge detection algorithm, right? So this is like you're using the pixel-based features, and edge detection algorithms are able to detect the curves, which are most probably edges, that somehow, edges. The word is pretty self-explanatory. And there's a lot of these algorithms out there, Kenny, whatever. And if you then do histograms, that is simple descriptive statistics, if you want, if you say this is a curve, right, that you detect, which is very likely to be an edge in the image, right? And then you can say what's the direction of these, let's say with respect to the normal, right? And you can do statistics on that. And obviously, this object here is not very likely to be a human figure, right? Because it has a significant different edge direction statistics than this one, right? And with that, you can comparatively easy come up with features that are also robust against a rotation in a certain way, and which effectively are able to detect the human shapes, right? And there is, for example, one family of features is called histograms of oriented gradients, right? Or histograms of gradients. And, this is something, if you just compute the gradient fields, so the gradient is the first derivative with respect to changes in pixels, then you can use these things as features, and they have proven to be very robust in that regard. Okay. Now, this is, separating the streams. So you can detect persons from audio, persons with respect to their faces or with their shapes from video, right? So now what's the matter with all the other features that we talked about? What about physical appearance? That's you. Okay. So again, you can use the same image-based features to come up with a classifier that tells you whether someone is endomorphic or ectomorphic, rather a thin or a fat person, right? Interesting might be this thing with the halo effect. Remember, what is beautiful is more competent, right? So it would be interesting to have a classifier that would be able to tell you the attractiveness of people, right? And we know from the respective research that there is clear indicators who is attractive and who is not, right? And one characteristic here is symmetry of the face, right? The more symmetric a face is, usually the more attractive it is perceived. And that is because attractiveness is a clear target function for evolutionary optimization, obviously. So some organism that is better adapted to its ecological niche would be a preferable mating partner in that simple model. So we're looking for organisms that biologically work. And if the gene expression works and the tissues are generated in order, then the result would be a higher degree of symmetry than if someone has a rather distorted shape, right? So distorted faces are perceived as less attractive than symmetric faces, right? And there is one of these, I think that's a student study that I took out these images from. If you do a morphing, if you take 500 women's faces and morph them together and take 500 men's faces, surprisingly, what turns out is that the men perceive the morphed women faces as very attractive. So let's take away the hair, because women wear a lot of more different hairstyles than men, and you see they don't survive the morphing. But from the face, it's what comes out is very symmetric, and the proportions are average. So average faces are beautiful faces in a certain way. And if you look through fashion catalogs or so, all the models basically look very similar among in certain with certain degrees of error. Whereas the men's face, if you do a very aggressive morphing, what comes out is that in a men's face, the testosterone levels produce these very edgy jaws, right? So this would be like the ideal super testosterone male face. And these edges don't survive the morphing, right? That's the reason why the morphed men's faces are not perceived on average as attractive by the women as the morphed women faces by the men, right? So on the right side, there is this result for the male, okay? And so with that, you can build algorithms that assess attractiveness, if you would like to have that, right? But again, ethics at work, right? So you have to decide whether you would really like that. I mean, it could be used in advantage of less attractive persons, but well, at least it's possible, and that's one thing in terms of physical appearance and social signals and indirect social signals. Next thing, which is next more complicated, is gestures. So with respect to posture, I'm going to talk about an example at the end of the lecture, but what's the matter with gestures? Okay. In order to be able to detect such thing as a gesture, right, a wink, for example, what would you have to do? First of all, you would have to select an appropriate feature space. And again, the pixels are maybe not as good. So what people use are these histograms of oriented gradients as features. And then you can either concatenate the image frames into a higher dimensional feature. So you say that I concatenate each, let's say I'm having 20 frames per second, right? That means that in 2 seconds I have 40 frames, right? And in each frame I have 100 dimensional feature space. So in the end I have 20 times 100. That is 2000 dimensional features. If I just concatenate them. And then I can use static classification again. But what you can also do is you can use classifiers that have time built in, okay? And one such thing, for example, is hidden Markov models. And in hidden Markov models, what you do is, so you have your world divided in time steps of some duration, let's say a second or 2 seconds. And in each time frame, you're having two things. You're having an internal model and you're having an output model, right? And what you say is that these models are indexed with time, and there is a state transition model that governs how these internal states are transformed across time, right? And there is an output that you measure that is generated solely by the internal state. So that's a first order hidden Markov model, because the output is only dependent on the input of the current state, as well as the new state is only dependent on the previous state, right? And so what you do is, the likelihood then would be the multiplication of this model that governs the internal transitions times the output. And what you simply do is, you only observe the output, but you can learn the whole model then with your with the techniques that we talked about, right? So that's a simple hidden Markov model. There's others like conditional random fields and others, and you might also employ techniques such as dynamic time warping, right? Which is in essence just a distance measure that compares two sequences of events, okay? And if I have a wink that goes like this compared to like this, the only difference is the speed. And what you have to identify is this part in the one series from this part in the other series, but I have to stretch time in order to make this into this, right? And dynamic time warping just, well, simply takes the two sequences and sees to which parts correspond to which. And the larger the distance, the larger the overall accumulated value of the distance is, right? And this is something that you can use to kind of normalize the speeds, right? And there's also things that work on posture, and I will, as I said, I'll give you an example later on. In terms of facial expressions, what you need to first do is face detection, again. And then in that face, you have to determine the action units, that is the simple discernible movements. And then you have to, well, interpret them according to the machine learning model that you learned, right? So, for example, you can either go for geometric faces, like the shapes of these facial components, the locations of some focal points. Here you see that certain parts that are elements of action units can be detected again with specialized classifiers, right? And then you would be able to compute transitions that would go for all these nice little things here. In BASIC, these are just slightly more complicated machine learning models that work with the same ideas. Compute some features, fit a model, and then you can, for example, classify such action units as being there or not there. And if one very simple thing is to work with so-called optical flows, right? And, well, what's that? Now, if you regard, let's say you convert your image into a grayscale image, right? And what you would like to detect is such a Spock-like movement of the eye, right? So that would be something where we have this to this, like this. Yeah, Spock movement. Really? I doubt that. Okay. Now, the only thing that happens is this eyebrow moves from here to here. Or I should say, maybe it's a better thing to have something like that. That would be much more Spocky. Okay. So what you have is that there is a transformation. So these ends somehow stay down and this one goes up. Right, so you're having a movement that goes like this, and you need to detect that. Okay, now what we see is that we're basically having three points for the eyebrow, and what happens is that these points stay the same while this one goes up. Okay, and what you need is that the intensity at that point is the same intensity at a later point in time. So what you can say is that if I compute this intensity as a function of space, three-dimensional space, or two-dimensional space plus time, then I say that at x plus dx and y plus dy at a later point in time, t plus dt, what do we have? What we do is, with this function, we just do a simple Taylor expansion. Okay, so that means that this is roughly the intensity at x, y, and t plus the gradient times the deviation. Okay, and then I have terms order of magnitude in the second derivative. Okay, so that's a first order Taylor approximation. Now, if you say that the intensity at this changed space at a later point in time, so this is x, y, and t, and this one here is x plus dx, y plus dy, and t plus dt, right? What I want is that the intensity is the same, because it's the same part of the eyebrow. It's just lifted, right? So what we have is that this expression here is the same as this, or in other words, this minus this is zero. And this minus this is just this term here, gradient times deviation. Okay? Now, here we have the components of the gradient and the deviation. If you would, well, this is like the dx here, right? You could also write this as delta x, right? And if you divide the whole equation by delta t, what you get is a velocity, right? Dx to the dt is nothing but the velocity in x direction. Okay? Now, and that's why if you, divide by dt if you like. Okay? So, di to the dx times dx plus di to the dy times dy plus di to the dt times dt is zero, and you divide by dt, so you get this equation. Okay? Gradient times the velocity. Okay? And this you can use to compute, for example, the velocity fields, right? So what's the, not only the points that you're interested in, but what's their velocity as a function of time and space? This is a simple vector field, which you can compute. And you can use this as features, because in that velocity field, you're having this spot movement as a characteristic pattern. That's all you need, right? So you can use these optical flows to compute these things, right? From audio, you can, for example, we already said that if you're into emotion detection, you can do this from speech prosody. So you don't, if you did the stuff with the speaker segmentation and you have the speech for one speaker, if you are after the emotion of that person, well, try to estimate pitch, tempo, and energy, for example. So pitch, you can try to assess as the first fundamental frequency in the Fourier spectrum. If I'm talking like this,
or if I'm talking like this.
Right? These are just the differences in pitch. And we already said that if you're under tension, if you're under fear or in rage, your muscles will contract and your voice will get higher, usually, right? And the tempo you can characterize as, for example, the vowels per second, because the vowels are phonetically especially relevant and they're particularly easy to detect in a way. And if you count that rate, you can you can try to assess the tempo that one is talking in. Again, if one is nervous, the tempo will be higher. If one is sad, of course, the tempo will be smaller. Energy is, as we said, proportional to the, roughly proportional to the square of the amplitude, right? And, well, these things you can use then as features for emotional assessment, again, with machine learning models. Learn a simple classifier on the basis of these models, and you'll be comparatively accurate, right? What is also a thing is if you're able to detect laughter, for example, or groans as simple items, right? So this is, again, a binary classifier. Take the frames and see to which one is laughter, which one is groaning. If you have that, you can have a very good estimation, because laughing is in general only associated with certain emotions, right? So there can be like a cynical laugh and a fun laugh, but there can be no such thing as a disgust laugh. This is, if you're disgusted, you just won't laugh. Even no one does that, right? And if you groan, if you're very happy, it's very unlikely that you do things like that, right? And so you can use these classifiers that are trained on non-linguistic vocalizations or even linguistic vocalizations to assess these things, right? So there is systematic research that shows that if people are lying, then they are using significantly less pronouns, for example, the pronoun I, because of, logical reasons. If I'm a liar, then I will like to distract the listener from me as a person, right? And if I'm able to detect these pronouns, for example, then I can do a lot of assessments in terms of that. And what's also possible is, for example, to deduce the personality traits. How neurotic is a person given the style of writing on Facebook? And there are papers that are able to detect this with, let's say, 80% accuracy, okay, which is quite good. Now, as you can see, it's a vast field, and there is a lot of work done there. If you're interested in that, it's a very good idea to be fit in machine learning, because that's basically the art form. And the art form is picking a model that is right, because when you pick a model of a certain kind, you're already injecting intelligence into the system, right? Because if you're choosing a model that is not very well suited to fit your data, then the results will be poor. And other ways are, for example, to detect to choose the features. Because, for example, if you use these MEL features for voice, you already inject domain knowledge, because you know there is a human speaking, and this is fine-tuned for other humans to understand. So this feature space construction is a way to make use of your domain knowledge. And this is then the interesting point, right? Because in the end, all machine learning models, you could just train anything on anything, but this is the art form that you need, okay? What we also said is that it's not only the signals, but in order to understand the cues and the signals, you need to know something about the context, right? So, for example, in this context here, which again is subject to detection, there's a lot of social signals that are very unlikely, right? So winking motions, laugh and wink, is that very likely? No, it's not very likely to occur. There's others that are more likely to occur, for example, silence patterns. Something like this, yeah? And so what we see is that context does play a role, and obviously what you need to do is you need to know the context, and in that context it's a good idea to not only have one source of signals, but to have many sources of signals. So for example, I did a paper where we combined audio features and accelerometer, basically based features, to detect social situations. Right, so that's two modalities. One is more geometric, one is more audio. And if you combine them, you will get a higher accuracy for what you're after. So that's this multimodal combination. Okay. Good. So applications, we already talked about that. So what Alex Pentland did was, for example, to predict the outcome of dyadic interactions, so whether a selling conversation will be successful or not via audios, okay, audio data. And yeah, well, mimicry patterns such as this mirroring is also something that we can detect. And what they also did was try to detect social influence by, for example, analyzing the influence that a certain way of talking of one person has on the way of talking of other persons, right? So I'm more influential the more I'm able to, make others behave like me than vice versa, okay? What they also did, for example, in terms of applying these things or, well, dealing with these is the analog of eigenfaces just applied on a multitude of measurements, for example, GPS measurements or others, concatenated and modeled over time. What they then get out is so-called eigenbehaviors, right? So then there are people that have a higher entropic behavior, that run around more, that meet more other people, compared to persons that are more nerdy and more seclusive and that just like to stay in one place and don't meet so many other people, right? And you can clearly distinguish them, and this is a nice paper if you want to read that by Alex Pentland about eigenbehaviors, okay? Good. There's a lot of other things, okay? Well, what a group of Björn Schuller did was, for example, to analyze roles and the small social networks in broadcast TV shows. I think they annotated several Arabella Kiesbauer talk shows from the early 1990s. And then we're able to assess certain social constellations there and other things. Okay. Now, what we will do for the rest of today is to look at one more specific example. And as I said, we're going to meet our Gaussian mixture models there again. Good. So, in mobile social networking, obviously, there is also long and short-term social context, and one form of short-term social context is social situations. I already talked about this. So if persons stand around and talk to each other, then we might call this a social situation. For example, something like this, three persons standing somewhere and talking, okay? Now, what is that? So a social situation is a co-located form of social interaction with full mutual awareness. So all the people that take part in the social situations know that they're in the situation and they know that the other persons also know, and they know that they know that they know, and this taken to infinity, right? So full awareness, co-located, and social interaction. And a simple model would be the set of IDs of the participating persons and the spatiotemporal region where this takes place. Okay. So for example, if we're having some large space and the persons are standing here, right, then one thing is to know, well, the rough space where these persons are in, something like this, right? And also maybe if augmented by time. If two persons walk from here, this is another person, and I walk from here to here, then this is nothing but a connected region in the three-dimensional space, something like that, right? So they have a certain location in space and time, so that's a space-time region that these persons walk in. And that would be something if, let's say, we're having a camera or another array of sensors measuring in a venue such as the Vienna Opera Ball, right? Then what are the social situations in there? That could be something. If you had them, you can do, for example, whatever. You can use them as retrieval keys for social life logging or other applications. Now, one way to do that is to say that If we're having a decentralized social networking scenario and everyone has a personal social networking agent, for example, running on his or her phone, right? Then we can use these agents and their attached sensors to let them talk to each other and do a decentralized detection of social situations. That would be like one possible setting that we could have. Okay. Good. So we already talked about. Well, what are principal ways to detect these social situations? So if you have microphones only, what you can then do, you can do speaker diarization, speaker detection, and then determine the set of interacting persons. Okay. And this would be like a very simple way to detect the persons that are actually interacting. And if you want to distinguish that in a very crowded space from the others, then you can also analyze the turn-taking patterns, right? Another way would be to use these rather geometry of interaction-oriented sensors. So if you have a gyroscope and an accelerometer, and even more so if you have an ultrasound sensor and actor in your mobile, then you would be able to retrieve the relative body distance and orientation, and that could be used to determine the set of interacting persons. Now, that is in contrast to social situation understanding. So once you have the social situation, you can use the signals, for example, to detect the emotions. And this is would be a way to classify the situation as this is an argument situation, or like an audience situation, or a hugging and loving situation, whatever you like, right? Determining the emotions and other higher level features. This is not what we're going to be talking about. Basically, we're going to be talking about this second part here, right? Now, we know that there are these four Hall zones of interpersonal distances, and we also know that they're influenced by, for example, culture, age, and architecture. That is something I explained yesterday. And this is with respect to the distances. With respect to the body angles, there is a theory that's called F-formation theory by Kendon, and that's in essence, rather simple, right? Because if you have three persons interacting, then they would be very likely be forming such an equi-angled triangle. If you have four persons, it would be something like that. If you have five and more, they would resemble more a circle in the end, right? And these are called F formations. Now, the question is there a method for measuring human social interaction geometry, which then can be used in such a sociological quantitative model? And is there a general quantitative algorithmically processable model for human social interaction geometry, right? So what Hall did was, on the basis of some sort of empirical research, he came up with this theory of four zones, right? But these four zones are, in Hall's original theory, circular shaped. But it's clear that, for example, my intimate zone is here, and in my back, I rather would care a bit less about intimacy, right? So it's not spherical. And what is also clear is that, for example, if two males are really standing face to face, this would be very confrontative, and you would avoid that normally. If we were standing there, we would form an angle like this, being open to the space, but not like this, most cases. So what is clear is that the simple model is not the only truth, and the question is, can we come up with a better model? And can we use that model to detect social situations from others? Okay. Can we distinguish that classifier-wise? Good. And what we can do is, for example, can we use these things in let's say, live logging or privacy systems, whatever. Okay. And what we did was this experiment. So the image I showed you yesterday, and what we did was we let people socially interact in a controlled way, and we attached to them passive infrared marker systems. And in that lab of Professor Nawab, there is a camera system of infrared cameras which are able to detect these markers position and orientation with high accuracy. So we were able to measure the interpersonal distances of the persons, so this here, as well as the body angle of the persons with a comparatively high accuracy using the infrared cameras that were attached to the room. Okay, so here you can see one of these cameras on the floor. There were in total 8 of them. And the system is fairly accurate. So the rotation is accurate to a degree of, one angle minute, and the distance is in the range of several millimeters, right? So that's really nice. So we were able to measure this, and well, this is just the way that we computed this geometry. You can be even more accurate if you use the polar angles as a third feature, right? Because that's, so obviously there is 2 angles involved here in that experiment. Maybe I do it here because that's quicker. But if we're having 2 persons and they're standing like this, right? So the first angle, if we take this person and measure the relative position, so the first angle would be this, right? So that's the polar angle of the person. But the polar angle stays the same no matter what this person rotates like, because it's related to its center, right? And this angle here would be the actual relative body angle. And then we have the distance. So that's basically a three value geometry here. But we only regard for the moment these 2 things, right? So the distance as well as the body angle. And we could maybe have, as a third feature, the overall density of distances, for example, in order to distinguish a crowded subway situation from an open space social situation. Okay. And what we then did, we manually annotated the data that we got, right? So, for example, in this setting here, what we investigate is the pairs of persons, right? And each pair of person has a value of a relative body angle and a distance. And here we see 2 social situations. So, but we have 5 persons, right? So how many pairs do we have? We have 5/2, that is 10 pairs. Yeah. And in these pairs, we have 4 pairs. This pair, this pair, this pair, and this pair, 4 pairs of person in a social situation, and 6 pairs of person, 6 pairs of persons that are not in a social situation. Like, for example, this pair here, right? Indicated by the red dotted lines. And we roughly had the same amount of persons in social situations in our experiment, compared to the number of persons that were not in social situations. Okay. Now the question is, what does the data look like, and can we build a model on that? Okay. So that is the image for the pairs of persons that are actually in social situations. Okay. So this on the x-axis, we always have the angle. And the angle ranges from 0 to pi or 0 to minus pi. So pi would be 180 degrees and minus pi would be minus 180 degrees. So what we already see is in these feature spaces with these 3 features, we have 2 angles and one distance, okay? So the distance is clear because r is in the range 0 to infinity. That's simple. But the angles have a certain problem with them. they have a torus geometry, because minus pi is equivalent to pi. So you would have to fold the image around, right? So they have spherical boundary conditions. So one feature with non-spherical boundary conditions and two features that have spherical boundary conditions, right? And in the PhD thesis by Alex Lehmann, there's a lot of discussion on this, but we'll very much simplify this here, right? So this is the result, right? And here we're having the distances, and these distances are then measured if you are in the back of someone, then this is a negative distance, and if you're in the front of someone, this is a positive distance. So with these signs here attached to R, or D, if you like, you would in a very simple way measure the polar angle, right? So this is the polar angle, and the only thing we do is we say if the polar angle is positive, or in the range of minus 90 degrees until plus 90 degrees, we give the distance a positive sign. And if the angle is goes in that region here, we will give it a negative sign. So in the front of people and in the back. So this is a very simple way to regard the polar angle. And these are just all the measurements for people, for pairs of people that are in a social interaction. And what we can see here, this white belt here is just the intimate zone, right? So no one stood in this half a meter range close to the people, right? And if we plot this as a heat map, what we can see is that there is two maxima here that are within the range of the socio-consultative zone, roughly, and at angles of pi half, right? Because the situations were such that persons would, in most cases, on average, have an angle of 90 degrees, right? So that's not this confrontative thing, but the geometry dictates that this is the overall most probable thing, right? And you can also plot this for D only if you integrate over all the angles. And here we see that this again is the intimate zone, and we are even having some local maxima structures here. If you regard the angles, you will see this characteristic distribution. And if we compare this to the pairs of situation of persons which are not in a social situation, we see that this angle distribution is very much flat, right? Because all the angles are randomly distributed. Whereas here, we can see characteristic angle distribution stemming from these F formations, right? Now, this is one class, this is the other class, and we can already see that the distribution here is much more diffuse than here, right? So again, if social context is in action, you find a very regulated, very regular type of interaction pattern, whereas in the cases where there is no social context, or almost no, then we find something that is very randomly spread out. And the only thing that is left to do is you need to train a model for each of the two situations, right? And what did we do? We used the Gaussian mixture model, right? And we used the Gaussian mixture model precisely in that place here, namely as a class conditional density, right? For this, we used a Gaussian mixture model. One Gaussian mixture model for the class of persons that interact, or the pairs, and a different Gaussian mixture model for the class of pairs of persons that did not interact, okay? So the class priors were almost equal for both sets. So we had roughly as many pairs in a situation compared to pairs not in a situation. And these are then Gaussian mixture models, right? In this case, so here is the the actual observations, and on the floor here are the isolines of the trained Gaussian mixture models with three Gaussians, right? And this is again a three Gaussian mixture model which looks similar but has slight differences that would allow us to use them in classification. And what we find is that for these numbers of Gaussians, we get an accuracy of around 75% in classifying the pairs correctly. Right? And this is a very simple social signal or social context processing system. Your target was to come up with a model, quantitative model, that would be able to somehow, well, replace the simple spherical Hall model that you could use for classifying pairs of persons as socially interacting or not. And this could then again be used as a pre-processing step for other social signal processing adventures that you would like to do. Okay, and well, in the end, a social situation may involve more than two persons. So what you need to do is you need to perform a clustering in the end to come up with the actual situations, right? And with this, for this clustering, we used a graph of persons where the edges were weighted with the probability that they would interact, normalized to one, right? So what you have is a weighted graph, and we know how to cluster in weighted graphs, right? This, for example, with single-link clustering or complete-link clustering, or even with maximum modularity, whatever you like. And then you come up with the actual clusters, and this is also very accurate. You would have to use different measures for accuracy, for example, the Rand index or adjusted Rand index, but this is also possible to recreate this with a high level of accuracy. Okay, good. And that was just one example where you find all your usual suspects that you learned in this lecture back again, right? And if you want to do other things such as gesture recognition or facial expression recognition and others, you would just have to employ different machine learning models and do the same program. Train them, do experiments, annotate them, have data sets, apply them, and so on, right? And the natures of data can be very different, right? If you, for example, had data from an online dating platform and you would, for example, have just the message frequencies, right? I think that would be a good measure to address average degrees of attractiveness. So you don't need all these feature processing, image processing magic. You can just count the number of times a single person has been contacted by others. That would be, to a high degree, be proportional to the person's attractiveness, right? If you were to do that. Or, as I said, if you would like to analyze the Facebook posting behavior, what you would then have is text-based features again, right? So what's the statistics on the usage of pronouns? What's the topic model that people talk about, right? And so there's a whole different bunch of features that you can use, text-based, geometry, sound, everything, and everything needs its appropriate machine learning models. Right. So currently one of my master's students is working on sentiment analysis. Well, the sentiment analysis would use text as features. You can maybe you can remember what I said about TF-IDF representations of text. That's a bit old-fashioned. These days people use word-to-vec representations which take care of the context that a word appears in. But in essence, these are just features. And then you put these features into classifiers, which are then able to classify the sentiment, the emotional tone of a piece of text, like a sentence, right? And this could be used for, let's say, addressing the emotional content of a social relation. Just analyze the messages that people write to each other, and then you know what possibly their attitude towards one another is, with some accuracy, right? And the word of caution always goes with respect to ethics, right? So privacy is a true concern, and it is a bit of a scary thing to imagine Google and all the other companies having access to all of your data, because they can do a lot of computations there, right? And it all has its impacts, right? So there's this story that is told, that was told at a conference by Jennifer Goldbeck, right? There was a depressive woman, a clinically depressive woman, and she was she posted a photo on Facebook with her being at a beach in a bikini smiling, and then her employer said, well, it's okay if you take a sick leave because you're depressive, but then if you show up at a beach, you're not really sick, right? And which is tragic, because obviously someone can suffer from a depression and still spend one day of happiness at the beach, right? And well, she lost her job because of this, right? So this is a privacy issue. And then there is other issues where, well, this is like a story where, for example, a Target, this American supermarket chain, did a lot of buying history analysis on their customers, and they would try to do some cross advertising. For example, if they found out that you were heavily buying whiskey, they would also sell you diapers for your child, right? Because they found that this is correlated, or advertise you with this, I should say. And then one day, a young lady of age 16 or so got a lot of advertising from Target with respect to pregnancy articles, right? And her father complained a lot to Target, because he said, well, my daughter is living a righteous life, and how can you dare to blah, 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 blah. And well, the end, and the story in the end was that the girl was actually pregnant, and Target knew before her father did, right? And yeah, it all has its implications, and we should be very aware. I've said this like 10 times, but I cannot emphasize this enough, as computer scientists, to not blindly follow the ways of these big data approaches, right? So always have privacy in mind. Good. Having said that, we'll meet next Tuesday.